Welcome to Real Estate Radio Live, an informative and engaging podcast discussing everything you need to know about the world of real estate. Your host, Joe Cacera, provides you with insight and guidance on how to buy, sell, finance, and invest in real estate. He also offers real estate tax management strategies, new construction advice, home improvement tips, and much, much more. And now, to guide you around the world of real estate, here's your host and Real Estate Radio Live team leader, Joe Cacera.
Hey, good afternoon. I'm not Joe Cacera. Joe has the afternoon off. This is Jack Russo again, and we're doing the series on growing your business in Silicon Valley. And I've been lucky enough this afternoon to have Professor Sam Savage from Stanford University, who is a good friend and colleague and longtime client and has done a number of startups. And the topic today that we're going to be discussing is the book that he's come out and the book that he's come out with. And he's, I guess, it's in a second edition now, right, Sam?
No, we're just pushing the second edition out the door.
Just coming, right? Flaw of Averages, which is a great book. And there's nothing like starting with the quote from Pliny the Elder, the Roman scholar: the only certainty is that nothing is certain. And that's so important for business. So welcome, Sam. And let's start by just you telling a little bit about yourself and where you grew up and how you made your way to Silicon Valley. Usually sure. What I like to say, because a lot of people, including me, came from the East Coast and they say, oh yeah, let me tell you, Silicon Valley was this place with no traffic and you could afford real estate and it was great. So tell us about that journey.
Yeah, sure. Well, first of all, a little correction. I am an adjunct professor, and at Stanford it goes, you know, tenured faculty, graduate students, and then adjunct professor.
That means you have more freedom to start businesses.
Exactly.
Right? That's the beauty of that.
I've started a bunch of them.
Right.
At this point, by the way, among other things, I'm the executive director of probabilitymanagement.org, which is a 501c3 nonprofit really aimed at curing the flaw of averages.
That's beautiful.
And I think we should explain what the flaw of averages
is. Of course.
I'm happy to say how I got here.
Yes.
By the way, my dad was a famous statistician and worked with Milton Friedman and a bunch of other very famous people. So I avoided statistics like the plague. The only thing my academic career has in common with my dad's is that we both flunked out of the University of Michigan.
No way.
Yeah,
I don't believe that.
No, absolutely.
And your dad was a famous statistician, but he flunked out of it. I went to the University of Michigan for about a year. It's an interesting story, but I motorcycle rode from New York through Canada. I can tell you that story offline. It's a great story. It's a great university.
It is.
Ann Arbor is a great town. The people are really smart, but it gets really cold in the winter.
Yep.
And it's still winter there now, I'm
absolutely
sure. A lot of snow.
Let's just explain what the flaw of averages is. So it's what happens when you replace an uncertainty with a single average number.
Yes.
Okay?
Yes.
Let's look at the uncertainty of climate change. It's a really good one. So imagine that we're not sure how much sea level rise we're going to get.
Yes.
Suppose 50 years from now in Palo Alto, you know, we're going to be affected by either zero sea level rise or 2 feet.
Yes.
Right? Well, the average is 1 foot.
Yes. You're saying it's equally probable that it could be zero.
Yeah, suppose it's equally likely to be zero or 2 feet. I'm just a simple math example so you can understand the math.
Yes.
Well, suppose that the economic damage if it's 1 foot is $1 million.
Right.
But the economic damage if it's 2 feet is $1 billion.
Changes everything.
Then if someone says, what's the damage going to be? Well, based on the average, it's going to be $1 million.
Yes.
But based on the fact that it's either zero or $1 billion, 50-50 chance, the average damage is $500 million.
Right.
So it's not like a small effect
here. No, it's big.
Right?
And in fact, as in law, that is called the learned hand formula that deals with the whole concept of when is something become negligent or not. If you do stupid things in the face of big liabilities, or sometimes called L, even small probabilities, what's sometimes called foreseeability, make a difference. So Boeing, for example, probably had a small probability of a huge liability, and arguably they're going to be found negligent because even a small probability of that kind of disaster, we're talking the 737 MAX that crashed, two different planes, lots of people dead, even if they say it was only a one in a million chance, the L of that P is so large, you cannot ignore it.
Right. And we'll get into risk management in a bit.
Yes, yes.
Well, let's start with this.
Yes.
So risk is a horribly defined word.
Yes.
So is there a risk that IBM stock's going to go down tomorrow?
Depends on your point of view, right?
Yeah, I've shorted this stuff, for God's sake. So risk for me is it goes up.
Yes.
Risk is in the eye of the beholder, right? So I divide the world into like a couple of things. You got uncertainty. Yeah, that's just part of the universe. Risk always is in the eye of the beholder. You have to take the stakeholder's point of view in mind.
Right.
So let's get back to this notion that the flaw of averages really exists. Let's go back to the flood.
Yes.
The average flood was 1 foot.
Yes.
It's never going to occur. Here, maybe you remember from your statistics course, the statistician who drowned in the river that's on average 3 feet deep.
Right, right.
That 3 feet doesn't do you any good.
Right.
Right? It was either 1 foot deep over here or 15 feet deep here in the middle.
Right.
Right. The average is really erroneous.
But business people make those mistakes all the time. They like to use averages. It's ingrained in our society, right?
Well, so part of that is that it's been easy to do, right? And at probabilitymanager.org, we're making it easy to do something else.
Okay.
But let's home in on this thing.
Yes.
This law of averages is so serious. When I was a math major, it was called Jensen's inequality.
Yes.
It's really just a public relations ploy to get the stuff out there. So I actually have, and it's so nice we can do this on radio.
Yes.
I have an audio logo for the flaw of averages.
This is a first, by the way, for this radio show that we now have audio usage to animate particular points.
Exactly, because
that's a good thing.
We don't have PowerPoint.
That's right. There you go.
Just to clarify what an audio logo is.
Famous Intel. By the way, that's a registered trademark.
Oh, yeah.
We covered this in last year's Starting Something.
Sure.
As you build a business, you generate trademarks and service marks and trade dress. But a lot of people don't realize sound can be a trademark.
Oh.
So sound, for example, it seems to me Uber and Lyft are missing that they could deliver a sound trademark to say, hey, we're 60 seconds away, pop that up on a phone, and all of a sudden people are waiting, I'm waiting for the ding ding, right?
That's right.
And they would make a fortune just being able to keep that brand.
Exactly.
As Intel has done with Intel Inside.
Well, so that,
and that sound.
Now I got to trademark the flaw of averages sound,
right,
which is this.
The crash. Okay,
so,
that's good.
So let me give you a more sobering example of the flaw of averages right away so you can picture it.
Okay.
Consider a drunk wandering back and forth on a busy highway.
Right.
His average position is the center line.
Yes.
That means the state of the drunk at his average position is alive, but on average, he's dead. Okay. See, this is not close enough even for government work.
That's right.
Right?
That's right. A lot of people don't realize that.
Yeah, so look, here's a business example, a Silicon Valley-type business example.
Yes.
You're in the software business. You got a big honking piece of software. You got to push out the door. And it consists of 10 subroutines.
Yes.
And that's all. And by the way, they're being developed in parallel by 10 teams. You can release the software as soon as the 10 subroutines are done. Are we certain about how long it takes to write software? Are you kidding?
Never. Right.
Never.
Yes.
But imagine these aren't really wild and crazy things. You're not pushing the envelope. Oh, we got to sort numbers. We got to look up things in databases. So we got a pretty good idea statistically. And imagine that each of the subroutines is going to take 6 weeks on average to complete.
Right.
Right?
In parallel.
In parallel. And then we're done, by the way. The calling routine has already been written.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
So the boss comes to you. Hey, Jack, when is the software going to be done?
Right.
Right? And you say, I don't know, boss, because I don't know how long subroutine one will take or subroutine. And then the boss says, give me a number.
Right, always.
Now, by the way, give me a number is the fork in the road to hell.
Yes.
Because once you go down that path,
right,
you can't describe the chance of anything happening. It's just like all that. Okay, so let's just ask this. Well, the boss will then say, could you give me an average? And then you say, well, heck, each of these things takes 6 weeks on average, so I'd say we ought to be done in 6 weeks.
Right.
Right? Okay, so what's the chance we're really going to be done in 6 weeks if each of the 10 subroutines can finish on average in 6 weeks? But hey, it could be more or less,
right?
Well, the answer is it's about 1 in 1,000, and I'll explain it this way. Suppose for each subroutine, you flip a coin.
50-50.
Heads is
a fair
longer
coin.
Than, yeah,
right.
Fair coin. Heads is longer than 6 weeks, tails is less than six
right.
weeks.
Right, 50-50.
Well, the only way everybody's going to come in at 6 weeks or less is if you flip 10 heads in a row. That's one in 1,024.
Which is really, really rare. Because you're doing the... There you go. You're building a brand there. That's good.
And you're going to trademark it for
me. No, it's good. So you would do the math on that by saying 2 times 2 is 4, times 2 is 8, times 2 is 16, times 2 is 32, until you get to 10, 24, 10 times,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
That's
exactly
what you do, basic statistics,
exactly.
Right?
But here's the point, and this is why the nonprofit has survived,
right,
and flourished and,
right,
grown.
Right, yes.
So it turns out that we have come up with a new way to an open standard,
yes,
for conveying uncertainty, which can be processed by Excel, by native Excel. Now, Excel couldn't do this always.
The spreadsheet. The Microsoft spreadsheet that took over for Lotus 1-2-3,
yeah,
and Lotus 1-2-3 took over for VisiCalc. We have long stories,
yeah,
about that
but
that go way back.
But those battles are now,
right,
over.
Right.
Excel is king.
Yes.
And Excel has a very powerful function called the data table that about 0.5% of all Excel users are,
right,
aware of.
Right.
And it used to be that this thing would blow up if you used it for large ensembles of numbers.
It was buggy, yeah.
But now it is incredibly powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And it works.
Works
beautifully.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
What this means is, first of all, we have an installed base of like 1 billion people who can use our open standard.
Right.
But let's go back to the idea of the sea level rise.
Right.
All right?
Right.
So there are only two outcomes there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we would store both those numbers at,
mm-hmm,
all times.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever you talk about sea level rise, I talk about two numbers.
Yes.
Right? Yeah, but I don't want to do that. Sea level rise is more complicated than that.
Right.
So I'm going to talk about 1,000 possible sea level rises,
mm-hmm,
or maybe 10,000 or 100,000.
As much data as you can get, right?
As you can get.
Right.
But what we're going to standardize on is having Excel simultaneously look at all these,
mm-hmm,
numbers with every keystroke.
Right.
And it's what's so astonishing is that Excel can do this with a data table.
And fast. And really fast.
Instantaneously,
mm-hmm,
fast.
Right.
And so one of the ways I like to compare this sort of is to the cartoon show Rick and Morty. If anyone's,
okay,
seen Rick and Morty,
okay,
it's a fabulous show. A science fiction,
mm-hmm,
cartoon about multiple universes.
Mm.
So what you want to do is keep all those multiple universes in mind with every calculation.
Right.
So we have a little model of a flood out at probabilitymanagement.org,
mm,
and what you'll see is that the damage associated with the average flood is zero. Yeah, but,
yeah,
on average, it's going to be $5.5 million,
right,
because,
right,
if the flood comes in greater than expected, you get a lot of damage. If it comes,
right,
in less than expected, you don't get any.
Right.
That's all part of this,
yes,
this concept.
So a lot of business people really don't get this. I want to make a point because it plays into growing your business. There is a certain foreseeability of potential liability almost across every business. I say this to people that are doing startups. A company came in, they're going to do a set of cosmetics, and they're going to do an internet site and all that jazz. I'll leave their name out to protect the innocent. And I said, you know, have you even thought about product liability insurance? And they said, why? This is like simple makeup stuff. Somebody's going to burn their eye or claim they burned their eye or put it in the wrong place or eat it and say, oh, well, you know what? I died. And they're going to say, but they didn't follow the instructions. I said, that's exactly right. You have to assume not only that Murphy's Law applies, but that Murphy was an optimist and that Murphy's Law plays out over and over again. And you know, a lot of business people don't get that because they don't understand the point you made about there's a certain chance that things are going to happen. You need to understand the distribution, not just the averages.
Well, and listen, this gets to a kind of a sore point with me.
Mm-hmm.
I've done work with the CPUC, the California Public,
yes,
Utilities Commission,
yes,
done work with PG&E.
Yes.
And because the world is sort of blind,
yes,
to the flaw of averages,
yes,
you get some horrible regulations.
Yes.
So let's just think about government regulation for a second. If we under-regulate, then we potentially put people and the planet at risk.
Arguably the Boeing case, because they're,
yep,
saying it was self-regulated without, yep, a lot of FAA oversight.
Yep.
Right? That's,
yep,
a good,
yep,
example.
If we over-regulate,
right,
we put the economy and potentially democracy at risk.
Correct. Right.
So there's a balance.
There's always a balance.
Guess what? If your regulation ignores the flaw of averages, you do both.
So
you endanger the economy.
Worst case outcome.
Yes.
Worst case outcome. Right. Lose.
You've got to understand the uncertainties. And let me tell you, in risk management, they don't. So let me just give you an example. You say, well, no one in a serious business would just use the average, right? So you can look up in a risk management textbook.
Yes.
One definition of risk is, you know, suppose if a transformer blows up, there's one chance in 10 that someone gets killed.
Mm-hmm.
All right?
Mm-hmm.
This definition, now this is the hand
formula,
which, right, by the way, was from the 20s.
Well, yeah, 1920s. That? Yeah.
So
famous judge.
And by the way, that was way before computers.
Yes, way before.
That was the best you could do.
Mm-hmm.
I'll grant them that.
Yep.
But we can do way better today.
Mm-hmm.
So let's sort of use that approach. We say, okay, one chance in 10 of someone getting killed.
Right.
So it's 1/10 times 1 gives us a risk score of 0.1 fatalities.
Right? Right.
And people are using this seriously.
Yes.
Great. Well, let me point out, if there's one chance in 100 of 10 people being killed.
Right.
Do the math. It's still 0.1 fatality.
Right.
Yeah, but what if it's one chance in 1,000 of killing 100 people?
Right. Yeah.
0.1 fatality. What if it is one chance in 74,600,000,000 of killing every last on Earth? 0.1 fatalities.
Yes. It's obvious that such an approach doesn't make sense, and it's probably what Boeing will get condemned for, because they made some judgment calls, and AI people are making judgment calls like this all the time.
Yeah. So I mean, I think we need a rational understanding of probability.
Yes.
So,
yes.
For example, if my product has a chance of killing you that is less than your chance of getting killed by an asteroid, am I still liable, right? Without understanding probability, you can't even get the laws going around this stuff.
Right, and lawyers are bad. Judges are arguably equally bad in dealing with probabilities.
Doctors are bad, by the way.
Most people fear a spreadsheet. The reason spreadsheets are only 1 billion people and not the whole planet. Everyone's got a computer. Everyone's got some device, but not everyone will feel comfortable dealing with numbers or a spreadsheet. And statistics,
Uncertainty, exactly.
Or uncertainty,
I mean, most people have had what I call, you know, post-statistics traumatic disorder, PTSD. But here's something in between I want to bring up.
Mm-hmm.
It's something I call unambiguous uncertainty.
Okay.
It's like uncertainty light.
Okay.
First of all, the way I would describe it, if we're rolling a die, okay?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Our open standard, the SIP math standard, we call it.
Mm-hmm.
We would simply roll a die 10,000 times, store it in an array.
Okay.
Someone would date it and initial it, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can look at it.
Yeah.
Someone can come back later on and say, well, that wasn't a fair die. Well,
yes.
You're entitled to do it because it's like an appendix in the contract, whatever, okay? It's unambiguous. It's just data.
Yes.
So now let me tell you the interesting experiments people have done along these lines.
Mm-hmm.
If I told you that I had a deck of 8 cards, and 4 of them were blue and 4 of them were red, and they're shuffled, right? And I said, gee, I want you to wager that the first card is red.
Hmm.
You're just going to say 50-50.
50-50, yeah. That would be my instinct.
Okay, now I say I've got 8 cards.
Mm-hmm.
They're entirely red and blue. That's the only cards in there. There's at least one red, and there's at least one blue.
Hmm.
I want you to wager that the top card is red. Now, you might have to think about it a little bit, but wait a minute.
It's not 50-50.
It's got to be 50.
Is it 50-50?
Sure it is. Well, which... What, is blue better? Is red better? There's at least one of each color.
Okay.
You have no information to take you away from 50-50.
Well, I'm thinking that you could have one red and 9 blues.
Yes, you could.
You could have...
The other way around.
One blue and 9 red.
And what's going to tip it one way or the other? It turns out nothing will tip it one way or the other. It's going to be 50-50. So mathematically, what's the difference? None. In reality, how do I tell the difference? I stick your damn head in an MRI machine, and with a second question, your amygdala lights up like a Christmas tree because of the ambiguity.
Ah, the ambiguity, okay.
So you've got unambiguous uncertainty in the first case.
Yes.
You know what it is. They're just shuffled. I can really relate to it.
Yes.
In the second case, you have ambiguous uncertainty.
Okay.
And they're all degrees of ambiguity, too. Maybe you could have some green cards in there. Well, then you're not going to bet 50-50 anymore, right?
Okay.
Now, this relates to work done by Nicholas Taleb, wrote some famous books like The Black Swan.
Oh, sure, Black Swan. A whole bunch of books now.
Right. And he has this thing he calls...
Fooled by Randomness.
Exactly.
One, right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. He has something he calls the ludic fallacy. Ludic comes from the word play.
Okay.
He says, if you try to understand uncertainty, based on dice and mm-hmm. spinners and things like games of chance,
right.
you're missing the boat. Well, I have something called the ludic fallacy, which is if you try to understand chance without understanding dice and spinners, you're out to lunch.
Okay, so you need both.
Well, you need the training wheels because people don't even think about the stuff right.
Mm-hmm.
So I like to think of it as uncertainty light.
Okay.
And so in a situation involving regulation, for example,
yes,
there should be auditable databases of the bad stuff that's happened.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And by the way, we want to hold you to these standards.
Right.
So if your company turns out to have 10 times as many fatalities, even 2 times as many fatalities.
Yes, you're an outlier.
You're an outlier,
right.
And we're going to pick that right up.
Right.
But I don't think we're going to get this regulation to work until we have these databases of uncertainties that we're working on. I just want to tell you the names of these things. So one of these columns of numbers I talked about, I call it a SIP.
Okay.
And I call it a SIP because I wanted it to adhere to the receptor in your brain that already has bit in it, right?
Uh-huh.
So think of probability is more fluid.
Okay.
You've got bits and bytes in there. You can deal with those. So with probability management, we have SIPs and slurps.
Okay. All right.
The SIP is the stochastic information packet.
Okay.
The slurp is tortured.
Yes.
It's the stochastic library unit with relationships preserved.
Okay.
But you need both.
But you want people to really think about probability in a way that becomes much more part of daily life.
Oh, absolutely.
Right? We don't do that. As humans, anywhere in the world, to my knowledge, right? Maybe in Yale, where you went, and other schools that you went.
Well,
if you're doing
we're getting there.
Are we getting there?
We're getting so our conference, our annual conference, is next week in San Jose.
Okay.
We've got nearly 50 people showing up with applications of probability management,
all
kinds of areas.
Okay, because this field and even in business is now starting to talk about evidence-based decision making. Like a client comes in and says to me, I've got a case in litigation. Give me a number. How much is the case worth? So it's very analogous, right? And my answer typically these days goes like this. Have you seen the TV program called Deal or No Deal with the guy Howie?
Right.
And he says, well, who's Howie? Well, then I describe her. I say, let's go on YouTube and just watch 5 minutes of it and you'll get it. You know, 26 different little suitcases that each have a number. And that number is obviously, you know, going to be getting from zero to like $1 million. And the goal is to figure out the case that has $1 million in it by eliminating cases. But the twist to the game is as you eliminate cases, there's a banker that wants to buy your case. So it takes some sort of mathematical, if not statistical, thinking. So the way they've enhanced the show, which maybe proves the point that you're making, that we are getting more literate, you know, we're getting more mathematically and statistically literate, is now you can actually sort of see some numbers that come on the screen where they tell you the statistical chances that the case is above a certain number is this. So they're trying to convey that the person in the driver's seat saying deal or no deal, he or she has to make a decision, and the average, not average, but expected value of the case that is there might be at or about the amount that the banker is saying. Usually the banker is low, but now they've added another twist. I just saw this show last night. I was exercising on the exercise bicycle. There was nothing on TV other than Trump tweeting someone. So I changed the channel. There's Deal or No Deal. And now they have counteroffer. In the new case, the person can make a counteroffer, and the banker gets to look at that. And litigation is like that. So I'll make the final point here.
Yeah.
You're removing different issues, different defenses, different arguments as you narrow down what the case is really about. You're either improving the value, or if you're a defendant, you're reducing the value. And that's what litigation is about. So I say, how many cases do you want to remove? Because every time you remove a case, it costs something.
Yeah.
And, you know, you get more clarity. You get more information. It's a little bit like sensitivity analysis. You start to understand, what are we really dealing with? But people don't understand it. You have to analogize.
So,
you have to have some common vocabulary for them to understand this.
So deal, no deal is the absolute perfect metaphor for this.
Yes, it is.
And it's the way economists have been teaching your risk aversion, right?
Yes.
We call it
risk
aversion.
Yes.
The fancy word, math word, is like utility theory.
Yes.
And of course, the way you think about this is, let's just do a deal, no deal here. I'm going to flip a coin.
Yes.
Heads, you get $10. tails, you get nothing, right? And I say, hey, Jack, would you walk? So on average, for $5.
Right.
I say, on average, you walk away for $2.
Right.
You say, hell no, flip the coin, right?
Right.
Now I up the stakes to you either get $1 billion or nothing.
Right.
And I say, would you walk away for $200 million? Well, you're going to take the $200 million.
Exactly. That's
because
right.
Because your risk attitude is, now, maybe Bill Gates would just walk away at that,
that's
too.
Right. That's right.
So and a bum on the street, by the way, would take the $2.
You bet. You bet.
So he can, you know.
Mm-hmm. You bet.
Buy a half a bottle of wine off some other wino.
Exactly. So I want to get back to what brought you to Silicon Valley, because one of the things I like to ask guests is, what's the magic that you see in Silicon Valley? Because you've moved here a while ago, and you've started a number of businesses, and now you're actually doing something which is great, which is very much the epitome of being a successful entrepreneur, which is now you're in the philanthropic and educational area of doing a nonprofit that you want to be successful.
Yes.
So tell us the journey.
Yeah.
Tell us about how you got here.
Sure. So, first of all, my dad was out here in 1964, I think, at the Center for Advanced Studies in Behavioral Sciences.
Ah, okay.
I visited
at Stanford.
Yeah.
At Stanford.
Okay. I visited him for a couple months. No, a couple weeks maybe. I was out here. And just fell in love with Palo Alto.
Right.
And
that happens.
And so.
A lot.
Then, I mean, had this very checkered career after flunking out of school. I finally got back in. I was a math major. Mm. I got a PhD in computational complexity, which is a field in computer science.
From where?
From Yale.
Wow.
But this is a long, arduous task.
Amazing.
I then,
quite a story.
But I mean, when I flunked out, you know, I raced a car. I became an automobile mechanic.
Ah,
And these are things. So what I was going to say is, in any endeavor in life, it's not what you earn, it's what you learn. You are picking up human capital.
All along the way.
Just all along the way.
Right.
And the weirder and more diverse that human capital is.
Yes.
The more combinations of ways you can put it together into some completely...
Like a Rubik's Cube.
Completely new combination no one would have thought
of. And people don't get that, which is why we like serial entrepreneurs. You're a serial entrepreneur. Because the serial entrepreneur tends to understand that failure is not just a number.
Right.
It's your point. That, you know how much I learned through that? Like even that woman that had that crashing failure could play the sound again in Theranos.
Yeah.
You know, she's in the news again because apparently there's some movie that's coming out.
Yeah.
And, you know, she's going to get a lot of play, but there's criminal charges pending against her and her partner, who was actually a romantic partner as well as a business partner. And, you know, they're facing criminal charges. And you think, gosh, you know, that's a disaster. But there's a certain forgiveness in Silicon Valley. They may come back. They may have a second life. They may be like, hey, we learned a lot about what not to do. We went too far. We learned something here.
It could be. I don't have much sympathy for people who commit fraud, to tell you the truth. There are a lot of ways to fail in business without committing fraud.
Of course.
But they say, you know, fail early, fail often.
Yes.
Here's a great example of that.
Yes. Learn along the way, for sure.
Anyone know the Klutz brothers who did juggling? The Klutz brothers juggling. Okay.
Yes.
I listened to one of those guys on the radio once.
Yes.
He said, you want to learn how to juggle? First thing you do is you take the juggling balls.
Yes.
You just toss them in the air and let them fall on the floor.
Right.
Fall on the floor.
Yes. You'll get tired doing that.
Yeah, but if when one falls on the floor, you get upset, you're never going to learn how to juggle.
Get used to it.
Get used to it by just having them fall on the floor.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
And so as it turns out, I started teaching at the University of Chicago at one point. I worked for General Motors for a year and a half. Got to Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Quickly discovered that I was in the business school. Discovered that 10% of the students understood what I was doing.
Yes.
Linear programming.
Yes.
10% of them would go off and apply it. So I was leading a 1% effective life.
Yes. Yeah.
And I was teaching management science. I considered it to be a moribund field, and I abandoned it. I kept teaching a couple courses, one in calculus and one in computer science, but I said, the university life is not for me.
Right.
And I went up and down Lincoln Avenue at night with my guitar, trying to become a folk singer.
Oh, okay. So
you had
sort of this separate evening life of making it in the big time.
Completely different world.
Okay.
Inspired by people like John Denver and Jim Croce and others.
Wow.
Steve Goodman. Anyway, so two things that really dissuaded me from a career in music were, number one, there were a lot of people who were much, much better than I was.
Mm.
The other thing was, they weren't making it either.
They were failing.
So
even if the really good people can't make it, maybe this isn't worth doing.
So at that, I was still not ready to go back to academia by any means. And I ended up inventing a crazy jigsaw puzzle based on the tessellation artwork of M.C. Escher.
Okay.
You can actually see this thing at schmuzzles.com. That's S-H-M-U-Z-Z-L-E-S.
So it's a play on the word puzzle.
It's a play on the word puzzle.
Okay.
Escher has these figures that are all identical but fit together.
Right.
So the normal puzzle is pieces of different shapes that fit together one way.
Yes.
This was a puzzle with one shape that fit together 168 factorial ways, which is more than the number of stars in the universe.
Wow. Okay. So same exact piece, but it fits together multiple different ways.
So let's talk about that failure, right?
Yes.
Made it into People magazine, into Wall Street Journal,
right.
Forbes. We started out losing like 50 cents a puzzle. By the time we were done, we were only losing a nickel a puzzle.
Not too bad. You're going in the right direction.
But what I learned was, I learned public relations.
Yes.
And I started out, you see, solving these mathematical problems like the traveling salesman problem.
Right.
You heard of that thing.
Right.
This is a field known as OR, Operations
Research,
right?
Yes, I remember.
Well, if you increment the first letter by just one, you go from OR to PR.
There you go.
Right? So
there
I was so close the whole time. And so now I've got, what do I have behind me? Well, the stage presence, I'm on stage.
Yeah,
the
you're
guitar,
good. You're good. You're good.
And then I've got, the public relations.
Mm-hmm.
So then it sort of all came together with these ideas around the flaw of averages, but that didn't mean I could actually solve the problem.
Yes.
And again, it took miracles. Look, none of my successes have been planned, and none of my plans have been successful.
But you've learned along the way.
That's
big.
And as Pasteur said,
yes,
chance favors the prepared mind.
Yes. Okay.
That's what the serial entrepreneur does.
That's right.
Is they have prepared their mind for things that most people wouldn't even dream of.
That's right. And that, by the way, and I've said this often, is the ultimate asset that Tesla has in keeping Elon Musk. Because Elon Musk, for whatever you want to say about the guy, and a lot of people say bad things, he is constantly inventing. In fact, he went on a podcast, the same one where he was smoking some form of smoke. I'm going to call it marijuana, but who knows what it was. And, he got a lot of flack for that. But he said, look, I can barely get any sleep. My mind is always percolating ideas. And, in fact, new outlet, he's got a Twitter account called Bored Musk, like B-O-R-E-D, Musk. And he just throws inventions and says, this is an invention, someone should run with it. This is an invention, someone should run with it. And he wants to spur, in the U.S., innovation. And, from Tesla's point of view, having someone like that, and particularly a CEO, that motivates people to do some amazing things. So, they've come out with a whole line of electric vehicles. Now they're electrifying homes with,
Well, how about the rockets, for God's sake?
And the rockets, which is a separate business. But, it's very hard to have and harness that creative talent in a public company because they tend to be eccentric and they tend to do wacky stuff, right?
Look, absolutely, Jack.
Right?
Come on. He has to be CEO.
Yes.
Look. I invent stuff myself.
Yes, you do.
They're crazy ideas.
Yes.
Well, people aren't going to do crazy stuff.
That's right.
So if you're working for someone else, they're not going to do it.
That's right.
You got it. The entrepreneur says, yeah, you think it's crazy.
Right.
But,
when Edison had the electric bulb, there were a lot of people that say, are you nuts?
Yeah.
Why would anyone want electricity? How's that ever going to happen?
And, of course, we're facing this with probabilitymanagement.org. And I want to getting close to the end here,
yes,
I think,
yes,
right?
We
so
are.
I want to so finish up with,
right.
with sort of what the goal is at our nonprofit,
please.
Which is to do for uncertainty what Arabic numerals did for numbers.
That's big.
Okay?
That's a big goal.
And so I have to bring out my role model here.
Okay.
Fibonacci. You've probably heard of Fibonacci.
Yes.
So what did Fibonacci bring to Italy in 1199? Mm-hmm. Absolutely nothing. Nada. Zilch. Zero. They actually did not have a symbol for zero in Italy in 1198.
They had
these Roman numerals, right?
Right, that's right. Starts with a Roman 1, then Roman 2.
Exactly.
Yes, I remember.
And by the way,
I took Latin 4 years in high school.
And these SIPs we have behave a lot like Arabic numerals because you can add them together, multiply them.
Yes.
Okay, So I want you to picture Fibonacci trudging around Italy in 1199,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
He says, I got this great new way to communicate and calculate numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Well, 80% of the population says, what's a number?
Yeah, right, exactly.
But the accountants and the regulators and those guys
right. All
say, well, can't you see we're busy? We have only 6 days to add up this column of Roman numerals. And Fibonacci says, but my way is so much faster.
Right.
And they say, we bill by the hour. And then he says, and my way is so transparent. And they say, and the horse you rode in on, why do you think our rates are so high?
That's right. Yeah, it sounds like law and accounting is all exactly. being broken now by automation, but we'll talk about that separately.
It took a few hundred years, and in that time period, though, no, Fibonacci himself got pretty rich as a consultant.
Oh, did he? Okay.
Because people did want to be able to calculate annuities and do changing
yes,
money, right?
That's right.
But sooner or later, the church came down on them, and they outlawed Arabic numerals in Florence, and, you know, it was a long, bloody battle.
Okay.
Let's just put it that way.
Okay.
But so we, you know, it's not
so
a big success.
It's a big goal in a nonprofit where it's not about money, it's about mission, and it's a big mission, and you're very motivated. You're doing it full-time, right, more or less full-time?
So I don't draw any money from that
okay.
at all. But like Fibonacci, people see what we're doing and we get some consulting jobs.
Okay. So it leads to opportunities.
Sure.
But you're doing a good thing for society. The question is, like, why wouldn't the federal government give you or probability management a big grant to say, we want to bring that literacy right into the high school? They should learn about how to use spreadsheets and how to do distributions and how to use all the tools that are available, like maybe even grade school
oh,
at
absolutely.
Some level, right?
Look, I'm glad you brought it
yes.
up. I've taught this stuff
yes.
in middle schools.
Yes.
In Beverly Hills, Palo Alto, and West Oakland.
Wow.
And
okay.
the kids, the little brains
yes.
are the same in all those
yes.
places.
Yes.
The kids are incredibly bright.
Yes.
And they eat this stuff up.
Right. So why aren't we doing that? I mean, just to end on kind of a note, are we like brain dead as a society that we're not recognizing that the computers are proliferating? The spreadsheets are available. The data, the big data, is flowing like a tap of water.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's just flowing in. We have plugs now for electricity. We have plugs now for internet, which means we have plugs for data.
Right? We should have plugs for probability.
I mean, it's happening, right?
Yeah.
Isn't it happening? But what are we just, in the federal government in particular, but even the state government, just still too illiterate to recognize the value of that literacy?
Well, look. That is the problem with inventions.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Just take Einstein.
Yes.
The physicists were too illiterate
yes.
to realize what he had done.
Yes. But right? if I were someone like Intel, maybe we should play their sound again as we end. That sound, and you got it. I mean, that's the sound of intelligence. That's what Intel, you know, Intel is the first few letters of the word intelligence. Intelligence is generic, but they've been able to carve out
yeah.
that trademark mm-hmm. and the audio. They should be totally behind what you're doing, because if they're not, then the outcome is the opposite, the crash. Let's do the crash one, too, and we can end on that. And by the way, are you the guitarist that's
oh,
playing
yeah,
the
oh,
guitar?
Yeah. Oh,
that's even,
that's my Martin
even
guitar.
So final remarks. Why don't you just make a final set of remarks about you've made the transition from entrepreneur having started a number of businesses, profit-making businesses, many failed. Some succeeded, to now the nonprofit. What would you say, like, in just wrapping up that journey, where are you having more fun?
Oh, my God. Okay.
Where are you having more fun?
So the nonprofit
yes.
is fabulous. No one fights over profits because there aren't any. No one's
good.
Plans get subsumed by some master
yes.
plan because there isn't one.
Yes.
But I tell you what, my income has gone up as a result, too.
Wow, that's interesting.
Because we're doing really good stuff that's coming from
yes.
the heart. Oh, and other people are joining us. This is now like Legoland.
That's beautiful.
I mean, I have said nothing about the people I'm working with,
yes.
a couple folks.
Yes.
Tom Keelan and Doug
yes.
Hubbard.
Yes.
Who have got inventions of their own. They're coming from my perspective, distant parts of the galaxy, and yet we're all
oh, beautiful.
Coming together. And,
oh, so
and,
the Brain Trust will be in San Jose next month, early next month.
No,
right?
no, this month.
This
next
month.
Tuesday and Wednesday.
Oh, next Tuesday and
you
Wednesday.
Go out
okay.
to our website,
oh,
probabilitymanagement.org.
Okay.
We still have seats
oh, good.
To learn about this
well,
stuff.
Well, maybe I can make it. Well, thanks for coming on, Sam. Thanks for sharing your wisdom. Joe, we hope you're back next week. We know you're getting better and getting over your sick leave, and we'll look forward to seeing you. But thanks for coming on, Sam. And by the way, you should say how people can reach you by email. Is it at probabilitymanagement.org?
Yes, Sam at probabilitymanagement.org. www.computerlawgroup.org.
Right. And I'm Jack Russo at Computer Law Group. It's www.computerlaw.com, 650-327-9800. It's J Russo, J-R-U-S-S-O, at computerlaw.com. Have a good afternoon.
You've been listening to Real Estate Radio Live. For more information on today's program, visit reradiolive.com. That's reradiolive.com. Subscribe to our podcast. Discover more at reradiolive.com.